This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest, Dexter Filkins, has been reporting on the resurgence of the Taliban in Afghanistan and the advances the Taliban have made in Pakistan, where they've come as close as 100 miles from the capital city of Islamabad. Filkins is on a brief visit to the U.S., so we invited him back to Fresh Air to tell us about what he's been seeing. Filkins is a foreign correspondent for the New York Times. He covered the war in Iraq from 2003 to 2006. His best-selling book, The Forever War, about America's conflict with Islamic fundamentalism, has just been published in paperback. Dexter Filkins, welcome back to Fresh Air. I'm going to quote something you wrote in a recent review of Tom Rick's book about General Petraeus. And in that review, in the Sunday New York Times book review, you said, "What can be won in Afghanistan? Driving around the country, as I did recently, one is constantly overwhelmed by how little has been accomplished there." Describe a little bit what you've seen driving around the country that leads to such concern.
Well, it's just, it's been 8 years. 8 years ago was, after 9/11 and the Americans went in, overturned the Taliban. 8 years is a long time. And there's no functioning state in that country, even today. And again, it's 8 years later, and they cannot really do it by themselves. They've never been able to. The country's completely destroyed. It looks like the fourth century in most of those places, and not entirely. I mean, the American military's done a lot of reconstruction, but for the most part, it is depressingly similar to what it was 8 years ago. At that point, after 25 years of war.
The Obama administration is sending in about 20,000 more troops this summer. What's your idea of what the Obama administration is trying to accomplish with the troops?
Well, I think what they want to do, it would be easy to imagine that, we're going to send 20,000 more troops in there and they're going to kill a bunch of people and they're going to defeat the Taliban. I don't think they really want to do that. I mean, any American military commander would tell you there's never been enough troops on the ground to secure the population, and that means keep the population safe. And so I think what they want to do is to use these troops to do that, just to put them in places where they haven't been before. I mean, and you can see this. I was in a helicopter recently flying over Kandahar and Helmand province, which is in the south, where the Taliban are very, very strong. There just aren't that many troops down there. And so as a result of that, the Taliban just have sort of a free run of the place. The idea is to use these troops to kind of, what they would say, secure the population.
And by secure the population, it means protecting them from the Taliban?
Basically. I mean, I think that's the idea. It sounds really simplistic, but it's make the population safe, make them feel secure, make them happy as much as you can. And by doing that, you make the Taliban irrelevant. It isn't so much that you kill them as there's no need for them.
Now, there have been some attempts toward negotiation between the United States and the Taliban and the Afghan government. What have those feelers been so far?
Well, they're just feelers. It's interesting. There are these very quiet, secret, really back channel negotiations going on, and what that really is just kind of passing notes through third parties. But it's very interesting to me, just because on one hand, you have, the Taliban, the leadership of the Taliban, Mullah Omar, etc. Most of them are thought to be in Quetta in Pakistan. They're kind of known collectively. There's five or six of them, the leadership. It's called the Quetta Shura. And, they put out these public statements all the time. And it's, we're going to fight until the end and we're going to fight forever and, jihad until doomsday. And yet at the same time, it's interesting to see that maybe they're in private, they're more flexible than that. And the Americans as well. The Americans are, we're going to kill off the Taliban or we're going to defeat the Taliban. But in fact, there's this very, very tentative kind of feeling out of each other. But it's so early and the positions are so far apart that I think, you don't want to make too much of it just yet. There's going to be a lot of fighting. I think we're in for a very, very violent summer.
Why do you think this summer is going to be particularly violent?
Well, the Afghans call it fighting season, and what that means is, the mountain passes, I mean, it's a very mountainous country. It's just too cold. You can't really move around. The passes are snowed in and frozen over, and particularly down the border, along the Pakistani border. And so, in summer is when everything thaws, and so that's when most of the violence is. I mean, you've already kind of beginning to see that. I think the violence is starting to go up, and there's been more attacks.
And fighting season this summer coincides with the Afghan elections.
Yes, the presidential elections are in August. And so I think you asked me what the 20,000 troops were going to be there for, and I think they are to secure the population, but they do have a very immediate task, which is to try to make the country secure enough so that they can have an election.
Last time you were on our show, we spoke a little bit about what the Americans are up against in Afghanistan in trying to do the equivalent of what they did in Iraq in winning over some of the insurgents. In Iraq, there were the Awakening Councils, where Americans actually paid insurgents to lay down their arms and join these Awakening Councils and be on the side of the Americans and the government. In a recent article about Afghanistan, you gave a really good example of what Americans are up against there. There was a Taliban commander who said he was willing to lay down his arms. Would you describe what happened to him?
Yeah, that was a really interesting case. Very instructive, too. I was in Wardak province, which is just west of Kabul, where the Americans are trying to, and they've actually had some great success so far in just bringing the violence down. The place was pretty much out of control even just a few months ago. It's pretty calm these days, but a Taliban commander had come forward with a number of fighters, 100 guys or something. He went to the governor of Wardak province and said, "I'm ready to quit." And the governor said, "Great, you know, fantastic." Kissed him on both cheeks and said, "Go ahead and go home." And so he went home, and a couple weeks after that, some guys came into his house, presumably it was the Taliban, and they killed him and his entire family. And I think that's what the Americans are up against there, or the Afghan government's up against there. As was said to me, there's no mechanism to kind of do this. You know, what do you do when a Taliban commander comes up to you and says, "Hey, I want to quit"? What do you do? You know, first of all, you've got to protect him. And they haven't done too well at that, because the moment these guys flip, they're targets, you know, and this guy was, you know, killed just a couple weeks after. And it was in that same province. I went to a big meeting of a bunch of Pashtun tribal leaders. And of course, the Pashtuns are the ethnic group that is kind of most closely identified with the Taliban. And the Americans were trying to get them to kind of participate in this local militia program. They're trying to get them to give them some volunteers for these kind of police force that they were setting up. And the Pashtun, you could tell they kind of wanted to do it. They were sort of interested in it. I mean, they weren't sort of adamantly opposed, but they were just afraid. And they had all gotten what they called night letters slipped under their doors. And they were there were notes that said, "If you cooperate, we kill you." And so they basically said, "Look, we can't cooperate, you know, because until you can protect us, you know, we got to protect ourselves."
Right. So that even the people who want to leave the Taliban kind of can't.
Right. I mean, by and large, though, I think it's – I mean, I'm thinking back to to late 2001 when the Americans went in and started bombing and then basically took down the Taliban government. It was such an incredible time. And I remember there was a period where there was the city of Kunduz, which is in northern Afghanistan, was encircled by the Northern Alliance, by the American-backed, you know, anti-Taliban fighters. And there were thousands of Taliban stuck inside the city. And over the course of a month, entire units of the Taliban defected. And they would just literally, I mean, we were standing on the edge of the city. I remember they would just drive out. They'd be talking on the radio. You know, they'd offer them whatever. They'd say, you know, "Come and be with us." You know, and I think they were offering them a lot of money too. But they would just literally drive out of the city, and they would get out of their cars, and everybody would hug and kiss, and everything was forgotten. And in many cases, the Taliban guys would literally turn around and start fighting against the guys whose side they were on just, you know, 24 hours before. So it was just incredible. So this stuff is sort of possible. I mean, war there is very, very strange. It's a very strange business. It's like pickup basketball, you know, shirts and skins.
Was it some ways easier, do you think, to topple a Taliban government than a Taliban insurgency? Because the government, there's a centralized government, and an insurgency is just like scattered all over, and there's no
yes.
power base to topple.
Well, that's right. The insurgency in Afghanistan is basically a rural insurgency. It's in the countryside. And if you look at, say, as opposed to Iraq, you know, the war was fought and won and lost in Baghdad, in Mosul, in the cities. Very, very urban. I mean, it's an urbanized society, Iraq is. Afghanistan is not. Most of the population lives in the countryside, in the mountains, in the villages, and that's where the Taliban is. And so you can drive around Kabul, and Kabul's very, very normal. You know, it's pretty common. I mean, you know, there's occasionally there's a suicide bombing, but those are actually pretty rare. And so you can see how difficult that is to combat, because you have this countryside which really resembles, you know, the Grand Canyon in many places. And I mean, that's really what it looks like. And there's kind of little villages dotting this great Grand Canyon. And you can just imagine how difficult that is to kind of get into those villages and try to sort of root the Taliban out. It's you know, next to impossible.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Dexter Filkins. He's been writing from Afghanistan and Pakistan for the New York Times, and he covered the war in Iraq from 2003 to 2006. His book, The Forever War, has just been published in paperback. The United States has been launching airstrikes in Afghanistan, and those airstrikes have turned out to be very controversial because a lot of people in Afghanistan say it's turning the Afghan people against the Americans because so many Afghan civilians are being injured. And I'm wondering on the ground if you've been close to any of those airstrikes and what kind of after effects you've witnessed.
Well, first of all, I think that's true. I mean, I think you've just had these kind of catastrophic, you know, incidents where there's a firefight or there's something going on, and the Americans call in an airstrike and inadvertently kill whatever, you know, 40, 50, 60 civilians. And that is just, you know, you can imagine. I mean, that's just horrendously unpopular, and it's not something that people forget. So I think there's a lot of concern in the military and in the Obama administration. You know, people like Secretary of Defense Gates have said as much, and Richard Holbrooke, the special envoy, that this is losing the war for the United States and for the Afghan government. I mean, these kind of mistakes. What happens typically, I think most of these mistakes happen for pretty much the same reasons. And what that usually is what the military would call troops in contact. And that means, for instance, there's a unit on the ground, they're around a village, they're moving around, and they come under attack. And with great urgency, they get on the radio and say, "Help us out, we're under attack. We're going to get killed here," and there isn't time, you know, to plan and to look around and to be careful about these things. And so they're just trying to rescue the troops that are in contact. So they drop a bunch of bombs, and maybe they kill some Taliban, but then they end up killing a lot of civilians as well. And so that's in a case like that, you can see why it's difficult to kind of curtail those things, because when your troops are on the ground, you want to save them. And In fact, I was on a foot patrol with some troops outside of Kandahar in a village where we came under attack, and we were pinned down for a long time, for about 45 minutes. And the Taliban were kind of on three sides. And they called in these helicopters to basically rescue us. You know, we were running out of ammunition. And in this case, it was a little, you know, we were in this village, but the village was kind of set back. And I would be surprised if any civilians were killed. We were basically in these big opium fields. And they blasted. These guys came in with rockets and they shot up everything. And then we kind of walked out of there and they fired some more artillery. And you can see the danger. I mean, it's just, you know, this is a densely populated country. And when this kind of stuff is flying around, people are going to get killed. But that's why it's difficult. I mean, I remember being pinned down by the Taliban, and I was, you know, facing the dirt and, you know, hoping that the airstrikes would come in as soon as possible. I mean, that's just kind of inevitable. And so you can see why it's so difficult.
This may be too personal to ask, but I can't help but wonder what was going through your mind when you were in the dirt, face down, hoping for the air attacks, thinking if the airstrikes don't happen, maybe that would be the end. You've been through so many years of covering war, of being in war zones, of risking your life, and like, there it is again.
Well, actually what I was thinking, it's funny. I was with a good friend of mine named Lindsay Adario, who's a photographer. And she's getting married in about a month. And I was thinking about Lindsay. She was lying down in the dirt too. And I remember thinking, my God, you're going to get married in a month. You know, you can't get killed now. But I was a little worried. But I'll just give you one bit from that. It's so strange when you get into a firefight like this in the middle of the day. Your brain, I think, doesn't really record it. It didn't really feel very real. And the Taliban were very close. I mean, they were really 50 yards away. And these helicopters came in right over our heads, you know, like 100 feet over our heads. And their guns were kind of blazing, these big machine guns they had. And the bullet casings were literally dropping onto us. You know, they were spilling out kind of from the guns and just showering us. I mean, that's how kind of close it was. And so it was just, it was surreal. It just didn't seem real. You know, I felt like it, I felt like the movie reel was going to run out at some point.
What was the purpose of the patrol that you were on? Like, what was the patrol doing?
It was some kind of operation they were doing to kind of clear an area. But I think the important thing was, and this is true all over, particularly in southern Afghanistan, there had been no American troops or British troops or any troops, you know, from the West or Afghan troops there in this area for years. And so it was kind of terra incognita. And so there was kind of an expectation that we'd come under attack just because it was assumed to be, you know, owned by the Taliban, which it was. And the other thing was, this was kind of opium country. And so, you know, the poppy fields were in full bloom, with the big pink flowers. And the Taliban, they basically preside over the opium poppy production, which means they protect it and they fight for it. And we had walked into this village. I think we'd walked about 3 miles through these fields. And we came to these opium fields into this village. And we literally were in the opium field for 5 minutes, and then we came under attack. And it was just really, it was automatic almost. It was like, get out of the opium field or get out of the poppy field. As the Marines arrive and as the soldiers arrive in southern Afghanistan, 20,000 of them, and they're going to basically be up and running by early August, late July, I think you're going to see a lot of that. You know, they're putting 10,000 Marines in Helmand Province, which is the center of opium production through the whole country. I think you're just going to see – you're going to see that all over the place. You know, the Marines walking into an area where nobody's been in years, and it's full of poppies and opium production and Taliban. So I think it's going to be pretty intense.
So you were in a poppy field, and the poppies are really important to the Taliban because
yes.
that funds them. They get their
yes.
money basically from yeah. from the opium and heroin trade.
Well, it's extraordinary. I mean, when you just look at the numbers, you know, pretty close to 60% of the GDP of Afghanistan is opium. I mean, think about that. And, you know, again, I mean, this is kind of this giant project, this kind of nation-building project that, you know, led by the United States and to a lesser extent the Brits and others. 8 years and 60% of the GDP is opium and poppy. And the Taliban are sort of sitting on top of that. And it isn't so much that the Taliban are growing the poppy and that they're transporting the opium. I think in some cases they are. But they tax it and they preside over it and they charge protection. And so they just kind of reap, you know, tens of millions of dollars, I think it's a safe bet, from the production of the opium. And so I remember when I wrote the last story I wrote a story about poppy and opium and the Taliban, and I got a bunch of emails from readers saying, why don't we just burn all the fields down, you know, just torch everything. And I suppose you could do that, but you would end up probably alienating the entire population. And so that's why it's difficult. I mean, I think that the idea is to kind of wean the farmers off of this stuff into something that's, you know, whether it's wheat or corn or whatever, but to sort of do that in the middle of a war. And so that's why it's so hard. But this is the kind of really interesting piece, I think, which makes it so difficult. Just under the rules of engagement that the Americans operate under there, they're not allowed to shoot people who are producing opium, producing poppy, smuggling. They're not allowed to kill them unless they're working with the Taliban. So
this is because they're not combatants, so they're not
exactly. They're not combatants, so they're just drug smugglers. So or they're farmers. I mean, and again, these are desperately poor people. So they're trying really to survive. They're just trying to survive. And in a lot of cases, there's a lot of coercion going on. And you know, the Taliban literally, as was told to me, you know, they provide the seeds, they bring you the seeds, they lend you money to do the planting, you know, they transport the crops, they, you know, after you've harvested them. I mean, they do kind of everything for you to facilitate this. So it's pretty complicated. So the Americans can't, for instance, go after just ordinary, you know, drug smugglers or poppy growers or whatever. And it's got to be what they call a nexus target. It's a connection between the poppy on one hand and the Taliban on the other. And when you talk to I mean, I didn't see this myself, but when you talk to some of the military guys there, they say usually when you find Taliban in southern Afghanistan, you find opium. Or when you find opium or poppy, you find the Taliban. So the two are very, very intertwined. And I think the idea, or one of the ideas over the summer, over this summer, with all these new troops coming in, is to kind of try to sever the connection between the Taliban and the poppy. And, I mean, I think they're going to be in for a very bloody fight, because that's the economic engine for the Taliban. That's where they get a good chunk of their money.
In Afghanistan, a new law went into effect. It's just for Shiite people, and it covers women and their home life. And it has some just really amazingly, I think, awful things in it. It makes it illegal for a woman to resist her husband's advances, thus legalizing marital rape. It requires a husband's permission for a woman to work outside the home or go to school. It makes it illegal for a woman to refuse to, quote, make herself up or, quote, dress up if that is what her husband wants. Ever since America toppled the Taliban government in Afghanistan, women were supposed to be more liberated. So why is it that now under the Karzai government, you know, Karzai signs into law this bill that sounds so awful for women and such a step backwards for women, in this case, Shiite women?
Right.
What happened that made the step backwards possible?
Well, I think the short answer is Karzai is running for president and in August, and he's trying to curry favor with the people who asked for this. And the people who asked for it were the Shiite clergy. And that's actually important. I mean, the Shiites in Afghanistan are a minority. It's a pretty small minority, maybe, you know, 20% of the population. And, you know, the difference, I mean, I'm going to speak in sort of very broad categories here, so I'm going to probably, you know, offend some people. But it's the Shiite clergy is kind of very organized and it's hierarchical in a way that the Sunni world is not. And so the Shiite clergy in this case kind of came forward and said, we want this law. We want this kind of whatever it was called, the domestic, you know, relations law, which, again, as you pointed out, contains just, you know, one provision after another, which is incredibly repressive of women. And so what was so remarkable to me in this case was that the women protested and all these women came forward and said, no, we don't accept this.
You were at a protest?
Yeah, I went to a
protest.
Would
you describe it?
Yeah, it was incredible. It was just it was extraordinary. It was amazing. I mean, this is a country where women basically don't have any rights. And that's what's a little strange about this law. I mean, this law is essentially codifying what exists for most women in Afghanistan anyway. I mean, most women don't have very many rights. Yes, it's changing. It's better than it was under the Taliban. But most women live lives which are really incomprehensible, I think, to or would be incomprehensible to most Westerners. I mean, you go into these villages, you don't see women. I mean, women aren't allowed outside, you know, and on the rare occasion that you do, you know, they have this sort of head-to-toe burqa. Their lives are so different than the rest of ours. And I think what was stunning to me was that, and it's a measure of how the society is changing, is that a large group of women came forward and said, We're not taking this. And so I was actually late getting to the demonstration. We'd heard about it. We'd heard that there was going to be a demonstration in Kabul, that these women were going to come forward. And I was sort of late getting out the door, and the traffic was bad, and I showed up late. And as I showed up, I saw this unbelievable scene. It was just extraordinary, where a bus, literally a big school bus, pulled up, and these women, these Shiite Afghan women, were getting off the bus to protest. And a lot of them had blue jeans on and they didn't have their hair covered. They were very modern looking, very young, you know, probably 18, 20, 25 years old. And they were getting off to join the other big group of women who were going to start marching. And they were just descended upon by these huge mob of men who were just shouting at them, whores, 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 get out of here, get out of here, bunch of whores. And the women kind of scattered and they were chasing after them. And it was just a horrendous scene. And I remember this one woman turned around and she faced down this huge group of men and she said, we want our rights. You know, we want equality. And the men were just, you know, whores. And so the women kind of ran off in terror, you know, and they scrambled back onto the school bus and the school bus kind of drove off and the men were beating on the sides of the bus and they were smashing the taillights. And God, it was just amazing. But the demonstration went on. I mean, there were probably 300 women in all demanding the rights. And they were very, very tough and provocative. They went – I mean, the demonstration literally started outside of the Shiite mosque that was the headquarters for the Ayatollah that was kind of asking for this new law, this new repressive law. So they literally gathered outside of this mosque and they started shouting into bullhorns, "We want our rights." And this is Afghanistan. You know, this is a place where women don't have rights.
You know, on a related note, you wrote a piece about a girls' school in Afghanistan. And tell us what happened there.
It was called the Mirwais School for Girls, and it's a girls' school outside of Kandahar in the south. And Kandahar's, you know, the most conservative place, practically the most conservative place on earth, but in Afghanistan, very, very, you know, you just don't see women at all. Back in December, as these girls were going to school, and the Mirwais School was built by the Japanese government. It's just one room. It's a pretty big school, but there's no electricity. There's really virtually nothing. It's surrounded by these high walls, and it's in this very kind of backward village just outside of Kandahar. And the girls come, you know, so one day back in December, three motorcycles, two guys on each one, started circling the school. And as the girls approached, they one by one went after these girls, pulled their burqas up over their head and threw acid in their faces and burned some of them, burned one girl in particular very, very badly. And I should just stop and say, you know, if there's one thing that's really, really changed since 2001, and I mean changed for the better, it's the education of girls. Under the Taliban, and I was there, under the Taliban, and girls didn't go to school. And, you know, I remember I was arrested by the Taliban and expelled from the country in the summer of 2000, about a year before 9/11. And I was looking for these underground secret girls' schools that parents were kind of running in their basements. And so the change has been remarkable, and it's just a unqualified, wonderful thing to go into these schools and see these 8-year-old girls running around and learning and kind of becoming human. And so these girls were badly burned, and the school closed, as most of them do. And so I had heard about this, and I just drove out to the Mirwais school to check on them. I was just sort of curious, you know, what's a closed girls' school look like? And I went in, the school had reopened, and all the girls were there, including the girls who'd been burned. And they were completely defiant. You know, they were like, "We're going to school," you know, and they all had a story. They said, you know, "My parents told me, you know, even if I'm killed, I have to go to school." So the Mirwais school is this kind of thriving place. So when I saw it, I was just kind of overwhelmed by it. And I wrote the story about these girls, these wonderful girls. And I was deluged with emails the next day. I mean, I must have gotten 500 in 24 hours. And so I set up this fund, and I think I'm up to about $32,000 that people have sent me in donations. And so I'm trying to do a couple of things. I went back to the school, and I had a shura. I had kind of an Afghan PTA meeting with the parents and the teachers. And so what they said they needed more than anything is a bus. So I'm going to buy them a bus, and I'm in the process of doing that right now. And I'm trying to get one of these girls to the United States for surgery on her eyes, who was badly burned by the acid, and on her face. Her name is Shamsia. But
Dexter, doesn't this
anyway,
make you more story. Of a Taliban target? Because you're not just reporting here, you're giving the girls' school a bus. You're taking a position on the girls' school and helping it thrive.
You know, look, if you're a Westerner in that country, in Kandahar, you're a target anyway. I mean, that's a very dangerous city, and the Taliban are kind of all over. And particularly in that area outside of Kandahar, the Taliban are everywhere. So I actually had to move in very, very quickly. I couldn't go in. I wanted to go to some of the houses of the parents of the girls, and that wasn't possible. You know, there's just Taliban everywhere. So, but once I get, you know, in this case, if I can get to the school, it's surrounded by these big high walls, and there's kind of a big courtyard and everything. And so all I have to do is get inside, and they close the doors, and then it's fine. You know, and it's fine for the girls. I mean, that's what's so wonderful about seeing this. You go in behind, you know, you're kind of in this village, which if you're a woman, you might as well be in the 4th century. And you go through this driveway and into this courtyard, and there's 300, you know, girls, you know, ranging in age from 6 to 13, and they're alive in ways that their mothers are not. They're laughing, they're jumping around, they're learning, they're reading, you know, they're playing, and it's just, God, it's an amazing thing to see. It is. And it's impossible not to have just great sympathy for what they're going through.
When you buy the bus for the school, it's a kind of emotional attachment that is maybe different from what you've done before as a journalist. Is this something new for you?
Yeah. Well, I've written many stories over the years in which people get in touch and they say, how can we help? And I'm happy to do that. I mean, in any way that I can. I've never been quite so overwhelmed with offers of help and sympathy as I have been in this case. And really hundreds and hundreds of people. And they're just writing checks and sending them to me so that now I have, you know, literally more than $30,000, I think, to kind of work with. And believe me, that is a king's sum in that country. And I'm going to use every dime of it. I'm kind of an NGO of one in this case. And I'm going to use every dime of it to help those girls because they're so cool and they're so adorable. And their lives are so hard.
And your editors are okay with that?
Yeah, sure, sure.
How are the girls who were deformed by the acid dealing with the scars? Are they covering their faces if their faces were burned, or are they defiantly not covering them? Like, what are they doing?
Well, they're wonderfully defiant. I mean, they pretty much all of them have returned to school. And of course, they have to, when they go out on the streets, even though they're, you know, 11 and 12 years old, they cover themselves as it is. But most of them have healed up pretty well. I mean, it's really just the one girl, Shamsia, who's 16, whose eyes were burned and has a big scar on the right side of her face, a big acid burn. And she's cool. She's just very, very confident and kind of alive and bubbly. I think she's having a hard time reading, which is one of the reasons I wanted to try to get her to the United States for surgery. But her father said something at one point to me, this is just kind of an example of what you're dealing with in that country. But he said, well, you know, she's never going to get married now because she's got this big scar on her face, which is essentially saying, you know, she's become a non-person in that country. And so I really do hope that I can get her to the United States, where I found there's an NGO that in the United States that arranges for these visits of children from the third world. And they find doctors, in this case Charlotte, at a hospital in Charlotte, North Carolina, where they would literally do the surgery on her eyes and her face for free. I just have to get her there, and it costs about, you know, $7,000 or so. And so all I need, you know, I mean, I've got the money, I've got the doctors lined up. I just need permission from her family. That's it.
And is that hard to get?
Yeah, they're scared. They're under threat from the Taliban. So they're worried about their lives. And so that's the trick. I'll be in Kabul on Saturday, and hopefully I'll be in Kandahar on Sunday, and I'm going to go see them and see if I can persuade them.
So just getting help for their daughter is risking their lives.
Yeah, that's what they say. And I believe them. You know, they're in this village, and the village is pretty much controlled by the Taliban. And, you know, any association with the United States or with the government in Kabul is potentially lethal to them. And so they're genuinely afraid. You know, I hope they'll take the chance because I think it's worth it. It's their decision to make. So I just hope there's a way to change this girl's life.
I want to leave some time here to talk about Pakistan because we've been focusing on Afghanistan. Yeah. As important as that is, it's
right.
Pakistan that has the nuclear weapons. And the Taliban are making a lot of advances there. In fact, last week, the Taliban warned people to evacuate several large cities, including Lahore, Islamabad, and Rawalpindi, saying that they were planning bombing attacks on government buildings and it wasn't going to be safe in the coming days and weeks. At the same time, the Pakistan army seems to have taken back a good, like the capital of the Swat Valley. And the Swat Valley is the part that was overtaken by the Taliban. So how does that balance out?
Well, I think it's one of the great ironies of the past 8 years that the Taliban are actually stronger in Pakistan than they are in Afghanistan. You know, they after the invasion in 2001, they were basically chased from Afghanistan. They the leadership and a bunch of them went to, you know, the tribal areas, this very remote area along the border in Pakistan, where there's no government to speak of. And over the course of the last 7 years, 8 years, they've reconstituted themselves, and they're growing, and they're stronger than ever. And so now we're really at a point, and again, it's a terrible paradox, but we're really at a point where the Taliban in that part of Pakistan are almost or virtually as strong as and have a sanctuary along with al-Qaeda, I think, as dangerous as the one that they had in Afghanistan in the summer of 2001. And you know, of course, there's no American troops on the ground in Pakistan trying to kill the Taliban, and so they've kind of been growing stronger and stronger. They're now, I mean, when they moved into Bunair, which is the you know, their latest conquest, and this is the one that, you know, they've been successfully pushed out of there for the time being. But they were 60 miles from the capital of Pakistan, and so. I mean, really, it's like a science fiction movie. I mean, Pakistan, it's 175 million people. You know, it has a literacy rate of about 30%, and it has nuclear weapons. And so you can just imagine.
When you think about Afghanistan and Pakistan, two countries which you're covering and which you're very worried about, how do your concerns compare about what the future might be for each of those countries?
Well, I think the real nightmare place now is it's less Afghanistan than it is Pakistan. I mean, again, Pakistan is this gigantic country, deeply troubled, kind of almost ungovernable, sitting on top of probably 50 or 60 nuclear warheads. Nobody really knows where the warheads are. The Americans certainly don't know where they are. And at the same time, you've got this history and the army and the intelligence agencies in Pakistan who have basically – they helped create the Taliban, and over the course of the past 7, 8 years, they've nurtured the Taliban and they've helped them reconstitute themselves and mount this and become stronger and stronger. And so it's this kind of double game. I mean, the United States relies on the Pakistani government, and they call them friends and they call them allies. And at the same time, there are elements of that very same government which are helping the Taliban. And so it's kind of an impossible situation. And I think what troubles me about the future, I mean, if you take Afghanistan and you look at what's happening there, and you know, all the new troops who are going in and all the resources that are going in there and have gone in there, and I kind of look at that, and I part of me is worried that even if the United States did everything right in Afghanistan, you know, which it hasn't done for 8 years, but even if it finally dedicated the resources and kind of got everything just right, that it can't succeed if this gigantic country of 175 million people is imploding right next to it. And so that, I think that's what worries me about the future.
Well, Dexter Filkins, we're out of time. Let's talk again on one of your trips back to the United States. We really appreciate your visits to Fresh Air, and thank you for all the reporting that you're doing in the New York Times. Have a good trip back to is it Afghanistan you're going to on Saturday?
Yeah. Okay. I'll be in Kabul on Saturday. Yep.
All right. Well, thank you again.
Thanks so much.
Dexter Filkins has been reporting from Pakistan and Afghanistan for the New York Times. His book, The Forever War, has just been published in paperback. Last night, Conan O'Brien made his debut as the host of The Tonight Show. So how did he do? Our TV critic David Bianculli has this review.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to The Tonight Show with Conan O'Brien. Thank you. Yeah. Thank you. Yeah. I have to admit, I think I've timed this moment perfectly. Think about it. I'm on a last place network. I moved to a state that's bankrupt, and tonight's show is sponsored by General Motors. That's pretty cool.
Outside of the reference to General Motors, Conan O'Brien didn't do any topical humor in his first monologue as host of NBC's Tonight Show. He didn't need to. He was the big story of the day. After 16 years as the host of the 12:30 Eastern Time Late Night Show, as the replacement for David Letterman, Conan was now moving to 11:30 and from New York to Los Angeles to replace Jay Leno. As TV goes, this was a very orderly transition of power. Conan had appeared as a guest on Jay's last show, and Conan expressed thanks to Jay last night on his first show. Conan also brought along Max Weinberg and company, who now get to call themselves the Tonight Show Band, and rehired Andy Richter, who had been Conan's late-night sidekick when they started back in 1993. Andy is an announcer now, but their relationship is the same. They still laugh the hardest at offhand remarks the studio audience doesn't seem to catch. So how was the first installment of this new Tonight Show? You can judge only so much from an initial outing, but first impressions do count, and they often turn out to be accurate. When Jimmy Fallon took over for Conan earlier this year, the first edition of his Late Night suggested that he was smart for hiring the Roots as his house band, but barely competent at delivering a monologue or interviewing a guest. More than a month later, that's still true. Conan's another matter. A lot of discussion before last night centered on how much of his late-night attitude and humor he could bring with him. For example, would Triumph the Insult Comic Dog work an hour earlier? Of course he will. Triumph is one of the funniest weapons in Conan's arsenal. But Conan has to woo the old Tonight Show viewers first, the ones who found Jay's non-threatening humor preferable to David Letterman's more caustic style over at CBS. That's why likable Will Ferrell was last night's only sit-down guest, and why tonight's guest is the super-likable Tom Hanks. Come on, folks, Conan is saying. If these guys like me, how bad can I be? The Conan who was on his best behavior last night wasn't that memorable, but wasn't trying to be. He was establishing a new baseline. New set, new logistics, slightly new behavior. Like a kid finally moving up to the adult table at Thanksgiving. The set is a lot classier, and, respecting the Tonight Show tradition, Conan has started out that way too. But not completely. Because another part of the Tonight Show tradition, going all the way back to original host Steve Allen, is what Conan does best. It's getting outside the studio, interacting with real people, and improvising. And now that Conan is playing in a new sandbox right on the Universal lot, some really funny material is only a tour guide tram away. Here he is commandeering a Universal tram from a tour guide named Drew and serving as an unofficial co-host. Drew points out various studio attractions and landmarks and tries to play it straight. But when Conan sees the flash floods from Earthquake, he gets very emotional. And when he sees a Norman Bates look-alike stuffing a corpse into a car trunk outside the house from Psycho, he gets very critical.
We're just going to do a little weather demonstration. We got thunder, we got lightning, and we have rain.
Oh my God! No! God! No! My God! Why, Drew? Why?
Ladies and gentlemen, that was either a flash flood or the Octomom's water just broke. That's some good stuff, people. That's some good stuff.
Let's just keep going in circles.
Yeah.
Just keep driving in circles. Can you keep driving in circles?
We have two of the most legendary sets in Hollywood, the Bates Motel and the original Psycho House.
Uh-oh.
Oh, there's Norman Bates right there.
Now, why do that in broad daylight? I'm just curious. Is it me, or is that just bad planning? If you're a criminal, you want to do that at...
Uh-oh. He spotted us.
He's unhappy. He didn't think anyone would see him in a theme park in broad daylight. Oh, no! No, it's too hot for corduroy. Wear a light poplin or a linen and commit the crimes at night.
My guess is that Conan will do just fine in the short run and hold the audience he has inherited, just as Jimmy Fallon has in Conan's old time slot. But that's the short run. Fortunes in late night TV, and believe me, fortunes are at stake here because The Tonight Show is one of NBC's biggest profit centers, are decided not by short sprints, but by grueling marathons. When Dave Letterman, upset at not getting The Tonight Show when Johnny Carson retired, moved to CBS, he won the late-night battle for a while. Then Jay Leno did that Hugh Grant interview about the hooker, opened with one perfectly phrased question, "What the hell were you thinking?" And he led in late night ever since. Now that it's Conan versus Dave in a head-to-head battle, there may be an incremental shift. The big question, though, is what happens this fall when Jay returns to NBC in a nightly primetime slot. How will that affect network TV in general and The Tonight Show in particular? If Jay succeeds, other networks will copy his success, and scripted dramas and comedies on broadcast TV will all but vanish. If Jay fails, he may take the ratings for NBC's local news affiliates and the ratings for The Tonight Show down with him. Either way, when you think about it, there's no happy ending. The only good news is that The Tonight Show, for now, is in very capable hands.
David Bianculli writes for the website TVWorthWatching.com and teaches at Rowan University. I'm Terry Gross.